Is the state overreacting to Endangered Species Act listings? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we'll try to get beyond the controversy over whether some little plant or flower is worth stopping a development project over. If you're in the fishing industry, you already know what happened when the Stellar Sea Lion was listed. Now we've got belugas, polar bears, eiders, and probably seals before long. Call us at 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@aprn.org. Endangered species the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. So if you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
What a great subject to do a talk show on. I think the endangered species is one of the most interesting pieces of law that the United States has. It has a long history, and what has happened as it's been litigated and gone through the court decisions is absolutely fascinating. It's also probably one of the most misunderstood laws in the country. I think a lot of that's because it the way it places the burden of proof. But we'll get into all that with our guest here. And your calls are welcome at any point because there are plenty of aspects of this thing to tackle it from at 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. And to talk this over with, we have a quite qualified expert with us by telephone. Dale D. Goebel is a law professor at the University of Idaho, author of the Endangered Species Act at 30, Volume 1, Renewing the Conservation Promise, and Volume 2, Conserving Biodiversity in Human-Dominated Landscapes. Now, I think it should be added that he didn't exactly write these, but he was an editor on this, and hence is obviously thoroughly backgrounded in this. And Dale, do you also teach ESA?
Yes, I do.
So assumedly, some of the lawyers who litigate this thing are probably former students of yours.
Well, I'm not so sure that I have any former students that do a whole lot of litigating on the ESA, but some.
Yeah. Well, okay, you know, it says this book, Endangered Species Act at 30, came out some time ago, and really you could say, I think, that the Endangered Species Act is more than 40 years old now, if you go back to the first laws, right?
Yes. The original federal statute on endangered species was enacted in 1966. Then there was another one that amended that in 1969, and then both of those were replaced by the current Endangered Species Act in 1973.
So we have a set of iterations, and we've also seen some pretty significant court tests of the ESA, and we've seen several, I mean, let's face it, a whole lot of hot air over it.
It does create interest, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I just remember the Teleco Dam thing, which probably a lot of our listeners are not old enough to remember. But basically, this was the idea that some little fish called the snail darter could stop a huge hydro project. And eventually, how did that actually come out?
Well, Congress subsequently, well, the case was initially decided by the Supreme Court, which shut down the dam project. And then Congress amended the Endangered Species Act to create a group of cabinet-level federal officers that could exempt projects from the ESA, and that group decided not to exempt the Teleco Dam, concluding that it wasn't worth the cost even when it was 90% finished. And then Congress came back, and there was a rider attached to a bill, and Senator Baker, from Tennessee had the dam exempted from the act.
So then they built the dam, and the snail darter was wiped out, except that they ended up finding more of them someplace.
Yes. Yes, they found more in other stretches of the Tennessee Valley.
So there it was. Would you say that that was a, then, you know, the way that the law worked on this was it was ended up being a very narrow exemption, right?
You mean the one that Baker did?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it only exempted Tillico Dam.
Yeah. So we didn't get any application to the broader legal questions.
The snail darter is a really unusual case. I mean, it's an extremely unusual situation where the entire known population of a species will be destroyed by a single project. People don't understand that the act generally doesn't involve that sort of a clear-cut yes-no kind of decision.
Yeah, well, clear-cut is definitely not about clear-cut. I got a note from the Fish and Wildlife Service when they heard about this program saying, you do realize, don't you, that most states have far more endangered species, more listed species, they said, than Alaska. Alaska only has 13, and you've got 330 in Hawaii, 302 in California, 108 in Florida, around 100 in Texas, Tennessee, Alabama, 75 in Puerto Rico, 50 in Oregon, 42 in New Mexico, 41 in Utah, and on down the line. So clearly, there's only seven states that have fewer listed species. But it still somehow reads that, to me it reads that this ESA is kind of closing in on Alaska, because we saw it with the Steller Sea Lion. I mean, they created no trawl zones as part of their recovery plan. Not that they've really recovered.
Yeah, no, I mean, recovery takes a long time generally. Whether it's closing in on Alaska, extinction or the threat of extinction is much more widespread and is getting more widespread with global climate change, increasing human populations, loss of habitat, all those kinds of things which drive extinctions. Are increasing the number of animals that are at risk. I'm not sure that Alaska is going to ever have anywhere near the number of species of Hawaii or California that are at risk of extinction, however.
Yeah, but it's some of that's just the way biology works, because we have more abundance and less diversity, and then you get further south, you get more diversity and less abundance.
Yes.
Or so they say. Well, I have heard it said and seen it written that the public will of the American people is pretty well spelled out in favor of the Endangered Species Act, or Congress would have repealed it by now. In other words, that the essential question of we really don't want to be wiping out the whatever the condor or the whooping crane is basically settled. The public does want to not make species extinct. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the public opinion polls you see suggest that the public, as a general sort of proposition, is in favor of preventing extinction. When it comes down to individual cases, of course, it gets a little more dicey. People do have problems with shutting down dams to protect small fish if they live in the area, or you know it's going to cause a loss of jobs or things in their area. Then people tend to see things a bit differently.
Yeah, the Center for Biological Diversity is obviously kind of the boogeyman for Alaska development interests right now, because this is an organization that, I don't know if I'd call it an extreme environmental group, but they're certainly an environmental group. They're largely formed from former government employees who wanted more of a conservation ethic really out of the government than they were able to get out of their professional involvement, and formed this interest group. And what they've done is litigated rather successfully, one might have to say, Endangered Species Act designations, and they're the ones that have brought the case on the polar bear and so forth, and appear to be trying to expand the jurisdiction. In other words, for seals or polar bears, it's clearly aimed at carbon dioxide emissions, much as the Fish and Wildlife Service is not interpreting it that way. So,
That's true.
So they're really, it seems to me that this, they're about this. This is their, what they view their job, their mission as, is to expand and use this one tool. Wouldn't you say that?
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, the Center for Biological Diversity, that is the tool that they think that they have to achieve the conservation of biological diversity on a broader scale. That's definitely the case. They are clearly the group now that brings by far the most suits, by far the most petitions to have species listed. They're the ones that are sort of poking the bear with a stick, if you will.
Yeah. And, you have to say that it's worked. But what I've noticed is that, and they've said this to me, but one thing I went to them with, I said, why are you always using the ESA? Aren't you just stretching it way out of shape? And they said, it's the only tool we've got. We'd love to have more tools, but this is the only one we've got. So, that's the way they're looking at it there. But it also seems that they are just, litigious. And their answer to that is that, the bureaucrats don't do anything if we don't sue them.
And yeah, I think that's clearly their point of view.
Well, there seems to be some truth in that. I mean, probably nothing would happen without a petition. And then once there is a petition, it seems like it takes legal action often to get things to move through each stage.
That is generally the case anymore. The problem is that there's not enough money, or that's one of the problems anyway. There's not enough money in the listing portion of the Department of the Interior's budget to list the number of species that they currently have on the candidate conservation list. It would take them, I think it was the last figures I saw, it would take them about 15 years to go through and make a determination on all of those species, given their current budget.
So basically the priorities get kicked up whenever there's litigation.
Sure. I mean, if you go to court and you sue and you win, then the court will require the agency to go through the listing process. So that essentially at this point, the only species that get listed are those that somebody sues on, because the agency simply doesn't have the time and the money to do anything else.
I think this is a good point to bring in the viewpoint. I just got by email from Rebecca Noblin, who is the staff attorney for CBD in Anchorage. And she says, fighting the Endangered Species Act is a waste of the state's resources. Decisions under the ESA must be made on the basis of the best available science, and the best available science shows that cooking, that belugas and polar bears, among others, are in decline and need protection. Rather than fighting a losing battle against science, the state should direct its resources towards conserving Alaska's iconic species. If we take action to protect polar bears, belugas, and other struggling species, the positive impacts will reverberate throughout the ecosystem and will lead to a better, healthier environment for all Alaskans. And so says the CBD. Now, when it comes to these belugas, this is kind of interesting because I was shocked when a court ruled that a run of salmon was a species. In other words, a particular run of salmon could be considered under the Endangered Species Act. It sort of took my breath away. But I guess, modern genetics kind of led us to this legal situation, didn't it?
Well, if you look at the definition of species, if there was a truth in naming of Species Act, I mean, the truth in naming of Federal Statutes Act, so you had to name it what it was, it would be the Endangered Species, Subspecies, or Distinct Vertebrate Population Protection Act.
Yes.
I mean, the definition of species is broader than species. It includes not only species, but also subspecies. and then populations of vertebrates. So that's the latter is generally what salmon runs get listed under. Generally, they're listed as something, as a population rather than as, I mean, everything is a species if it fits within the definition in the Act. But generally what they're listing is a population.
And so we have this situation with the beluga whale, which at some point, belugas made Cook Inlet, which is pretty far south for them, mm-hmm. a part of their habitat. And I guess now, and we've done shows on this where people have called up and reported sighting belugas a number of other places now in Alaska. But regardless, this population then, for whatever reason, became isolated and became a distinct breeding entity. In other words, as far as they know, these belugas don't, mm-hmm. they completely breed within their own population now. And then there were pressures on them, mostly subsistence hunting, which dropped their population. There may have been other pressures, environmental pressures, the ecosystem. I don't think anybody's really sure, but the fact of the matter is it's a distinct population and it's in decline, and they kind of had to do something about it when it was petitioned and litigated. So they did. Now they have a recovery plan or a critical habitat designation, sorry. And there's a great deal of nervousness about all the existing economic activity in Cook Inlet and what is likely to happen now that their habitat includes areas that are also being, let's say, dredged, where they want to build a dam, where our sewer plant outfall occurs, where there's offshore oil rigs. All these things would appear to be potentially affected. At what point would the Endangered Species Act and this listing of the beluga whale, at what point do you think would it actually start cutting?
Well, when you look at the definition of critical habitat, it is not the area per se, but it is the things in the area that the species relies upon. It's those aspects of the habitat that are defined as critical. So if you look at the decision to define habitat, that definition will include what it is about the habitat that's important. And I'm not really all that familiar with beluga whales. We don't have any in the Snake River down here, so I'm sort of
right.
somewhat at a loss to know a whole lot about them.
Right, right. And actually... And actually, Fish and Wildlife Service was happy to help us understand all of this. But generally speaking, I guess as the law is likely to apply to it, and as you've explained it, it would be what it is that they need as a species. So this could
right.
be their food, or this could be a place that they need to be, or a place they need to pass through, and sort of things like that. Now, what happens then, as I understand it, is there's a requirement for consultation whenever there's
right.
some kind of pinch. In other words, we want to build this bridge, and we'd have to put pilings in here, and there's only one part of the thing that is deep, and that's where they'd have to, like, I guess, take measurements and so forth, and see.
To the consultation requirement under the Act is triggered off if a federal action is involved. In other words, if the federal government were paying for the bridge, or if the federal government were building the bridge, or if the permit required, or if the bridge required a federal permit, which a bridge would in fact require a federal permit, so it would trigger off a consultation requirement.
Yeah, even if it was a completely state-funded and toll-funded bridge, I guess you would say, well, you're still going to have wetlands permits and things like that.
Well, I mean, I presume that the bridge would be going across navigable waters, and if it was going across navigable waters, it would require a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers generally.
Okay, so jurisdiction does apply.
Yes. Yeah, so there would have to then be consultation on whether or not the proposed action would in fact adversely affect the habitat. And so that would be the issue that would have to be consulted on and sort of negotiated through.
Well, now here's where the burden of proof part comes, because what if they don't know?
Yeah. Well, you make a decision based upon the best available science.
And you could be sued.
Well, you can be sued no matter what.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the things about the legal system is you can be sued. It takes like $50, and that's all it takes to sue somebody. So you can always be sued. The question is how likely it is that you will lose if you're sued, and how long it will take to arrive at some kind of conclusion to the litigation. In other words, how much delay can be built into the thing.
All right. But as I understand it, under the Endangered Species Act, the burden of proof is that you have to prove that it wouldn't harm. So that could mean then that ultimately, if it went through the courts and everything, that the people that wanted to build a bridge might have to do a bunch of extra testing to show that the belugas wouldn't be affected.
May well be the case, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that there's uncertainty in the science, then the agency's decision will have a lot of deference given to it in the court. So it's up to the agency initially to decide where the balance of scientific evidence is.
Hmm.
There's not an assignment of a burden of proof per se under the Act. The decisions are just supposed to be based upon the best available science.
So theoretically, the consultation might just let things go through, and if nobody disputed it, that would really be the end of the ESA problem.
Yes, yes. I mean, if the agencies consult and there's a decision that it would not adversely affect critical habitat, then unless somebody sued challenging that decision, that would be the end of the matter.
Hmm. Now I'm wondering about the polar bears. It's my understanding that an important part of their habitat is actually seals. And not only are the polar bears dependent on the sea ice, but so are the seals.
Mm-hmm.
And the research on the seals is very, very incomplete. So it could be that we actually have a whole food chain situation. I mean, because clearly something drastic happened when the sea ice started withdrawing more in the summertime, as it has for 3 years now.
Yeah, because walrus, for example, are now pauling out on land as opposed to ice.
Yeah, and walrus is probably, coming up next.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, they say, well, we don't really know. And boy, are they ever right. There's so much they don't know about walrus. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, there's so much we don't know about what's going to happen with global climate change in general. And so figuring out the impacts on species is a pretty difficult task.
Yeah. Well, I'm just, I mean, it's being said to me from one side, well, look, we don't see a time in the future where all the polar bears in the world are going to disappear, because there's just bound to be a bunch of sea ice up in those upper islands of Canada and over towards Greenland, and they'll still be there. It's more a question of the polar bears in the area around Alaska and over Mackenzie Way. You know, they might not find it advisable to be living there anymore.
Or maybe even possible.
Yeah, and we got the denning situation, and I guess there are, nobody really knows how much they can adapt to shore habitat, but they've certainly been trying for the last few years, as anybody mm-hmm. who lives there can tell you. But boy, I'm just trying to see where the jurisdiction is if they can't find a distinct population of polar bears, and I think they're madly scrambling around on that, then is the extinction risk finding going to hold if there's still going to be some habitat someplace in the world?
I would think so. The way the Act works isn't whether or not it will be effective in preventing extinction. The question is the narrower one, are the species at risk of extinction? And they're either at, are they at risk of extinction now, or are they foreseeable, are they at risk in the foreseeable future? And my understanding, which I will not stack up against the scientist, is that there are a number of different breeding populations scattered around the North Pole, and I'm not sure the boundaries of all of those. But arguably, the species is foreseeably at risk of extinction, given the loss of sea ice and the global climate change problem.
My guest is Dale Goble. He's a law professor at University of Idaho, and he's kind of guiding us through interpreting the Endangered Species Act and sorting out how it works procedurally. How often do you think the law gets changed in its, 30-odd year history? In other words, Congress has done some changes, and the courts have elaborated the interpretation, I guess you could say.
Right. The Act has been amended four times, but the last time it was amended was 1988. Since then, most of the, if you will, amendments to it have been done by the agencies adopting regulations or policies. The Act itself is fairly broad. I mean, we didn't know much about extinction in 1973, and so the Act is drawn fairly broadly, and the agencies have been going through and defining things and cutting back or expanding on things as issues arise before them. Then those generally wind up in the court, and the court has a whack at it as well. So that the changes to the Act or to the interpretation of the Act or to the use of the Act over the last, 20-odd years now, 30 years almost, have been primarily by what the agencies have done and how the courts have responded to those actions.
Has the Supreme Court wanted to take these up, or as these have gone up through the appeals court, have they generally just simply turned these cases down and not really wanted to mess with it?
Well, the Supreme Court's decided, I think, three, maybe four cases under the ESA, which is a very, very tiny fraction of the total number of ESA cases. So I don't think they're real interested in taking on ESA cases. The problem is that the questions are awfully fairly narrow and technical, so that the Supreme Court deals with, far broader kind of questions. The cases that they've taken up, for example, are whether or not the Secretary's definition of harm under the statutory definition of take is a permissible one. That has fairly broad ramifications because the Secretary defined it to include changes to habitat that ended up killing species. So that's the kind of question the Supreme Court would tend to take up. It isn't going to be, what about, the third comma in the next paragraph kind of question. So I don't think that the Supreme Court's likely to take a whole lot of ESA cases.
Well, this the Salmon Run decision, which is pretty old one by now, is that at risk, do you think, in the courts, or is that pretty well settled?
That seems to be pretty well settled. It's been heavily litigated in the Pacific Northwest because all of the runs, salmon runs into Idaho, for example, are listed under the Act. And there have been challenges, a number of different kinds of challenges to the listing decisions for the various salmon species or salmon runs. And the courts have pretty much worked it out at this point, it seems, so that it doesn't seem likely that those kind of decisions are going to get... I mean, it's always possible, but it just doesn't seem likely at this point. I was a betting man, I would not bet on it. How's that?
All right. How's it been working out for you? I mean, there you sit in the state of Idaho, and there the Salmon River sits without any salmon in it, or maybe it does have a few.
It still has a few. So, not very many. That's sure. That's for sure. Nothing like the runs you have.
Oh no, for now.
we would like to have some of those. I can tell you.
Well, and this is complicated. I mean, if you actually look at the geography of it, you've got all this hydro there, and you have all these fish ladders that some work, some don't, and on and so forth like that. By the time you get across the divide over where you are, or you know, I guess you're into the basin, right, when you say
right.
That? That, you know, these fish have had a lot to go through.
They have. The biggest problem is actually going downstream rather than coming up.
Really?
Yeah, because little fish don't go through turbines well.
Oh, no. I don't reckon they do.
They tend to be, you know, sort of ground up by going through turbines. So
yeah.
They barge salmon downstream these days, mostly.
Oh, that's mitigation.
Yeah, it's something, isn't it?
Enhancement, I guess we'd call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, or something, one of those.
It's a Endangered Species Act of the subject. Professor Dale Goble is our guest. The telephone number is 1-800-479-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. We'll get to your calls when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com.
This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, you can fight the flu by regularly disinfecting hard surfaces, avoid touching your mouth, nose, and eyes, and wear a face mask if you are sick and in close contact with others. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
When my best friend and I went off to college, I went to an art school and he went to a real college, and he considered a career in the law. And I remember getting together, we used to have these great bull sessions, as we called them back then, mm-hmm. and we'd talk about all these great ideas we were discovering. And he said, you know, I'm really attracted to the law. And I said, well, the law is the law. I mean... What to be attracted to? And he said, no, the law is not the law. He said, the law is a living thing. It evolves. It changes. And it's constantly being changed. He says, it's absolutely fascinating. He ended up becoming a librarian. But nonetheless...
So he didn't like change.
I think that, no, actually, at the ultimate analysis, he really didn't. But the thing is, this... I can't think of a more living part of the law than the Endangered Species Act. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
No, I think that's true. I mean, it because what we're learning about the biology of it, of extinction, is changing how we understand the act. The act, as I said, you know, it's a fairly broad statute. The language is broad. And so as the science changes and as our understanding of the problems change... the Act responds to those because that's how we now understand what the Act attempted to do. So yeah, it's a very dynamic body of law,
and it's probably going to form a continuing moral challenge to Americans, I would think, because we have tampered with our environment so drastically that these things are just going to keep coming back at us. It's not just one little snail darter, in other words. I mean, when you look at the number of species, 302 listed species in California.
Yeah.
But I guess a lot of those have been resolved. I mean, they just basically find a way to keep the habitat, put a plan in effect and deal with it. I mean, because we have thousands of them now.
Yes. I think that's where the movement is. Now, it is to adjust what people do and how they do it to the needs of other species. And broadly, one can see that is what the Act intended to do all along, is to sort of adjust things so that we could live with the other species and they could live with us. And so in that sense, there's a lot of progress that's being made, because there is a lot more sort of give and take with developers, for example, in California. I mean, it's just part of doing business in California these days.
And so if there's some kind of a gopher or rat or something there, you got to deal with it, and they've come to know that.
Yes, we broadly are beginning to figure out ways to do a lot of those things as well.
Yeah, let's go to Nikos, joins the program from Anchorage. Nikos, always a pleasure. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Nikos, are you there?
Yes, hello. Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine, Nikos.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate how fair and balanced you are, inclusive of many people in our communities.
I have a friend that's a newscaster with Fox now, and he's always saying he's fair and balanced.
Right. Well, I think that you're doing a good job of informing everybody. And I was born in Anchorage, and my father was a fishing guide. I've been a commercial fisherman before. I'm an Indian from the Columbia River. I'm a Salish Indian from Montana. And, you know, I work at Alaska Intertribal Council, a tribal liaison, as well as I've been a participant observer with the Cook Inlet Marine Mammal Council. And when we're talking about the process of listing the Cook Inlet beluga whale, which is a unique subspecies, I've been working on this one for 9 years, and I think in the reporting of this issue, there's been a lot of media manipulation where the customary traditional cultural subsistence whalers in Cook Inlet have been rather maligned.
Maligned is, they definitely come out of this not looking very good. But in truth, they were also very under-regulated.
Well, maybe, but the thing is that you need, just from the tribal standpoint, I'm trying to put a little extra dimension in your conversation here. If we're to look at the science, we've had very specious studies of the actual population of belugas in Cook Inlet, and I'm talking about historically. The traditional elders have counts that go back, you know, into the 1800s. And if you were to look at actual population counts, there was a Kenai Yankee Whaling Club that would go out and shoot belugas at the turn of the century for sport.
Good point.
And, it's important to recognize that there's other jurisdictions. One of the questions that comes out is in the critical habitat listing of the Cook Inlet belugas, are we going to have federal jurisdiction? I mean, it's been state jurisdiction, but there's also, in the United States, there's three natural resource trustees. There's the state, the feds, and the tribes. Well, there are multiple tribes that have a whaling tradition, and then under federal law, other whaling cultures, have people who reside in the Cook Inlet region, have rights to go hunting in their customary and traditional manner. In many of the common this is one of the most complicated endangered species listings that we've ever seen. So when you look at the endangered species listing, the Cook Inlet beluga whales, which is a unique subspecies, the traditional hunters were very much underrepresented in the comments. You can look at the supplemental environmental impact statement. We've registered comments from multiple groups over the years. And we found, I also work with a nonprofit public interest law firm known as the Center for Water Advocacy. We found that there was definitely room for environmental justice civil rights complaints for how the hunters' fish hunting rights were handled in the scoping process for the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement on the subsistence harvest of the cook and the belugas.
Nikos, I think this is going to have to go to another program because it just will take an awfully long time to keep going through this background, which I think is just terrific background, and I do intend to come back to it. But I think to cut to the chase, the Beluga Commission, I think it needs to be pointed out, did voluntarily curtail harvesting.
Now, remember, we have a Beluga Commission that receives federal funding, but the Cook Inlet Marine Mammal Commission has representation from federal agencies as well as the tribes in the region, and they did voluntarily step down. But
your point is that does not obviate the potential human rights complaint.
No, and furthermore, we really need to take a look at how the pollution problem in Cook Inlet. Tribes do have jurisdiction, and there actually are tribal water quality ordinances. I'll leave you with a question, Steve.
All right, Nikos.
Why does Anchorage have the designated wastewater treatment system that it does, and why aren't we receiving federal money to improve that? It's a wake-up call when a capstone species, a dynamic neighbor like the Cook Inlet beluga whale, is sinking and saturated in pollution. You know, what does that do for tourism?
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Nikos. Yeah, this is a question of Dale Goble, you may choose or not choose to comment on, but essentially our sewage plant in Anchorage, which is like almost half the people in Alaska, does not have to do any secondary treatment on its sewage. It just gets dumped into those complicated gravelly tides out there. And there is concern that there is going to be some extra expense because of this beluga listing.
It sounds like it might increase cost, doesn't it?
It might, but I'm wondering, where does the federal permit and jurisdiction cut here? Do you have any idea?
If you're going to dump a pollutant into a navigable water, a water of the United States, then you need a permit to do that. I presume that the waste treatment plant already has a federal permit.
Oh, of course.
And not being an authority on the Clean Water Act, I'm not sure what kind of reopeners exist on those permits.
Well, Nikos was also bringing up a question of tribal jurisdiction. Any comment you might want to put on to that?
The federal government recognizes that tribes are resource managers, like states and like the federal government itself. But under our constitutional scheme of government, the federal government is paramount in those areas that it has authority for, and the endangered species is one of those. And so when it comes to decisions to list endangered species, neither states nor tribes can prevent that from happening.
How did the tribes or did the tribes play into the Salmon River issue and the salmon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the Columbia River Basin?
Yeah.
The tribes have more biologists than the feds or the states do in the Columbia River situation. The tribes, there was extensive litigation. Indian treaty rights was the civil rights movement in the Pacific Northwest. It was broadly very, very similar to the civil rights movement in the South. The same kind of issues were raised and the same kind of state hostility to claims of federal rights that trump state actions. So it's broadly similar. But the result that came out of it was that the tribes and the federal government and the states are now broadly co-equal managers of the salmon in the Columbia River Basin.
Okay, well, that's somewhat similar to what we're moving towards in Alaska with their marine mammal commissions of various sorts.
I would guess so, yeah. I mean, that's the way, to the extent that you can get people sitting down around tables and talking to one another, That tends to be a preferable way than litigation.
Do you have any comments to make about Dale Goebel is our guest, law professor, University of Idaho, and he teaches Endangered Species Act, and he's written about it. Do you have any read on Holder and his Justice Department and what we're likely to see on ESA out of them? Are they the kind of pragmatists that we're seeing elsewhere in the Obama administration?
It's hard to say what the Obama administration is going to do. They haven't done much yet.
They did settle Cobell today. You did see. I don't know if you saw that. That just broke a couple hours ago.
No, I haven't. I haven't noticed that.
Yeah, they settled the Cobell case over the trust fund.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did notice that. Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. But yeah, I mean, they have not moved much in the ESA area. So I think a lot of the environmental groups have been rather disappointed in the lack of action from the new administration. They haven't appointed a whole lot of important people yet within Interior, so things are just moving slowly. It's hard to say what, in fact, they are going to do.
Okay.
And how they're going to change things.
Yeah, well, the move in Alaska, the beluga, I would interpret, I might be totally wrong, but it's really quite conservative and pragmatic.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't see a dramatic break with the Bush administration.
Yeah. Let's go to Roberta, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roberta.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I'm surprised we continue to use the term extreme environmentalist.
You didn't hear me use it.
Yeah. And we don't use the term extreme development, i.e. oil and gas companies dumping, drilling muds in Cook Inlet and offshore drilling, and extreme coal companies, Chuitna for an example, extreme pebble partnership. So for the last 20 years, the state has ignored the belugas. And I'm going to point some fingers here, and the finger of blame goes straight to the development, oil and gas, sewage from all the towns that go into Cook Inlet, ships, and boats, and the native hunters actually stepped up to the plate when they're turned into be a problem, and they stopped hunting. But the oil and gas people just kept doing the same thing. And I've got a thought: when money talks, rational thinking walks, and you follow the money, and you'll see decisions were made to make money, period. So I'm for smarter decisions. And I'm on this 4E's template, which is for all projects, which you use ecology, economy, energy, and ethics. And the project has to pass all four before we even talk about it. And I just still think that that is a simple idea, and we could go backwards and look at all the projects that are going on now, all the damage that has been done in the name of jobs and development. And when Dave said, the fact is that we need to learn to live with other species and they with us, and we need to, if the oil industry had decent respect for the whales 20 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, we wouldn't be in this mess right now. So those are my comments. Thank you very much.
Roberta, thank you. Thank you for organizing and structuring that so nicely. Roberta from Homer, thank you very much for your call. Dale, did you say extreme environmental groups? I don't remember.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think I did either. But I remember Ted Stevens used to. He always just stick this extreme on the front.
Yeah, my senators do so as well.
Okay, well, let's take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Attention hunters, you must apply now for all drawing hunts and for all Tier 1 and Tier 2 hunts in 2010 and in 2011. There's no application period in the spring of 2010. Applications must be postmarked by December 15th, so get your application in the mail now. Or you can apply online until December 31st. Information online at wildlife.alaska.gov or 1-907-267-2257. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We'll be right back.
It's Talk of Alaska, and it's a hot session on the Endangered Species Act today. Our guest is Dale Goble, a law professor at the University of Idaho. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. We're running low on time. You might want to just email talk@aprn.org, as Mary did, and she echoed what the woman for the Center for Biological Diversity said. Let's conserve the species. Protect the resources we humans depend on, like the fish we eat that swim through the sewage and leachate from our landfills that are dumped into Cook Inlet. Well, Dale, I'm wondering if you were stirred by the woman from Homer who seemed to want to say, look, we just need to be more rational about our development. It seems to me that if you take the longer view of the development of the environmental ethic, it's been quite the evolution.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that since 66, 69, and 73, our understanding of extinction has changed fundamentally. And I think that the changes have been largely for the best. If you look at the number of species that are listed, a number of them have been delisted as recovered, and a substantial number of them are in much better shape now than when they were listed originally. And that's been done without bankrupting the country or putting a lot of people out of work.
So you figure you probably will continue to have students who want to study the Endangered Species Act?
It's a form of job security.
Let's go to Carl, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Carl.
All right, great. Jamai, thank you for allowing me to be on here. I'm a Yupik from the great Yupik Nation, and I just wanted to thank you guys for opening up the lines here for this important discussion, especially here in Alaska. You know, my grandfather over here in Cook Inlet, before the first seismic booms, when they're using really large explosives to test here in Cook Inlet, he was out trapping along the Susitna in Matanuska Valley, and then he heard these thunderous booms and thought it might be World War III, and so he went up to the top of the mountain with his dog sled team and saw the oil companies coming in doing their seismic testing. So that was 50 years ago. Now, 50 years later, they're still continuing to do seismic testing. It's a little bit different, but it still has a great impact on those whales. We saw a whale come up on the beach here over in Cook Inlet, still being investigated. They took the head off, but from what some of the local folks saw, that it looked like it was bleeding from the same spots where there's been seismic testing done. And I know Chevron's been doing testing. So even to this day, even though the listing is endangered, they're still continuing. So I just thought I'd put that in perspective, as well as like the thousands of gallons of sewage that are just leaching in from the municipality of Anchorage. The wastewater and sewage, the primary treatment is... And the runoff from these huge airports that are conducting business for these companies and commerce for international trade through Ted Stevens, their de-icer gets straight into the inlet. So we're pumping raw sewage into the inlet, all these de-icing agents into the inlet. And not only that, the woman from Homer talked about the 23 platforms that are continuing to dump. So I think something has changed as progress, the mythology of progress and development heads to the Arctic, Bristol Bay, and the Arctic Ocean. And they're talking about the Chukchi and Beaupert.
Carl, I think you've made a really good point about the seismic, and I wanted to go to Dale Goble on that one. How has ESA cut on this issue of making booms under the water? Because, of course, there's quite a lot of seismic coming yet.
Yeah. My guess is, and as I say, I'm not a real expert on belugas. But
yeah, what we've seen so far, I think, is mostly it's the Marine Mammal Protection Act that has had the jurisdiction, and they use an incidental take permit system for the seismic.
Yeah, they probably would do the same thing under the ESA. There's also an incidental take permit under the ESA.
Mm-hmm.
So those, I mean, the two... the Marine Mammal Act and the ESA tend to operate very similarly when it comes to that.
Yeah, and you say you're not a Clean Water Act guy, but clearly the Carl raised this issue of runoff, and I'm kind of wondering about that.
Well, it depends on what you mean exactly by runoff. If it's not coming out of a pipe, if it's not a point source, in other words, then there's actually very little federal regulation of those kinds of things.
Okay. Let's go to Paul.
Land uses generally don't get regulated.
All right. Let's go to Paul in Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Paul.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
I got a few comments.
All right. Well, if you can keep it fairly short, because we are running out of time. We've got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, the Exxon oil spill was a major one. The military base had a lot of toxic stuff. The sports fisher have a lot of hooks that get into the salmons, and then they go out to sea, and then they get into the belugas, and the belugas get their lungs punctured, so they drown. And the commercial fishers is over-harvesting. And the other thing is the hooligans are not, that's what they depend on. They're not returning back. And this has been going on for years and years. I used to be out there when I was 5 years old. I'm pretty close to 60 now, and I used to be out there before all the oil companies were there. And ever since the oil companies came and the cities became bigger, they just kept having a major impact on it. There used to be thousands and thousands of belugas. Now they're down to nothing. And what it is mass starvation of the species by the sports, commercial, and everybody's impact on it. But mainly, I think it's all of the cities, Talkeetna, Wasilla, Palmer, all the big cities dumping their sewers into the ocean. So that
yeah. Has the beluga, is that personal experience that the beluga runs have declined? The hooligan?
No, they were always a lot of them.
I mean, people are still netting hooligan.
The tomcods, too, and they're all gone.
Huh.
And there used to be sticklebacks and everything that they used to feed on. And I imagine when I was seal hunting when I was 5 years old, way out there.
All right. Paul, I want to thank you so much for your call. Boy, the benefits of experience. Dale Goble, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for being our expert du jour. Clearly, plenty more to talk about. We'll be back on belugas later on. Dave Waldron at the controls, Pat Yak, BD Trentina on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.